The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anika Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the October-November issue of 17 Magazine and the November issue of Glamour Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, welcome back, everyone, and welcome to November. Actually, it's the middle of November, today being the 15th already. And I'm going to start off with the editor's letter for Glamour Magazine, the November issue. You're holding in your hands our future issue and their favorite sources to look into their crystal balls and make some predictions about how everything from our shopping habits to the halls of Congress will change in the next 5 to 15 years. I think we'll be spot on about many of them, but I'm just as sure we'll get a few wrong. In some ways, it's like we're living Moore's Law, so named for Gordon Moore, who predicted in 1965 that computing speeds would double every 2 years, with the world turning faster and faster around us. Life is changing so quickly, with every industry, including ours, disrupted by new ideas and new inventions. It's impossible to predict everything that's coming next. So, how can you be ready for such massive shifts? My suggestion? Start by being open to all the changes. Throw any fear out the window. Be flexible about what might come your way, and chase the thing that excites you. 5 years ago, I was a producer for BBC World News, working on air and covering the war in Syria, the appointment of Pope Francis, the changing tech landscape in Myanmar. But the constant throughout more than 15 years of journalism was how women's stories excited me. In Nigeria, I saw how new technology opened banking options for women, helping them lead more independent lives in a culture that has long forced them to be dependent on their fathers and brothers. In Papua New Guinea, I couldn't forget witnessing a wife being beaten in the street by her husband, while no one blinked an eye because violence against women is so accepted there. Recognizing that women's stories were the ones I talked about most to my friends and relentlessly pitched to my bosses is what led me to this fabulous job at Glamour. Find that constant in your life. Another thing that will guide us in the future, how we connect with others. As you'll learn from senior editor Maddie Kahn's reporting on how Congress might change if more women are finally elected to that body, the way female senators reach out and discuss the issues with their male and female colleagues has already changed history. As so many exciting and new developments come down the pike, we can't forget those essential human skills. Compassion, empathy, understanding, optimism. Those are the things that will make our future a bright one. Samantha Berry, Editor-in-Chief. P.S. One more big change? This month's cover. 10 years ago, if you had told an editor she'd be shooting a magazine cover with a phone, she would have given you a blank stare. But for this issue, we did just that, photographing the trio of trailblazers from This Is Us on our cover this month with the Google Pixel 3. Welcome to the future. All right, so we're going to get started right off with what happens when you add a woman here and here and here. Some researchers predict a 30% female Congress would overhaul Washington. But will women bridge the divide or just join it? And there is a picture of Congress with everybody sitting around one very long and wide table, and the arrows pointing to three different men, and that's where they're asking, what happens when you add a woman here, and here, and here? All right, this is hashtag think, elevating the conversation. The end of the 2013 government shutdown started with pizza, wine, and 20-ish frustrated female senators. It was Aaron Sorkin-esque, except zero men were present. By the first week of October, the partisan battle had dragged Washington to a halt. Senator Jean Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, invited the women to her office to discuss a plan to reopen the government that Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, had put forth. There were a lot of people, men, who would have liked to be the bullies on the playground and just cross their arms and see who had to back down first. Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, recalls, "We didn't want to wait to see who backed down. She's heard that women politicians are more polite and more patient than men, but that wasn't their motivation. What we were was impatient to finish it, to get back to business." When the shutdown ended at last, the late Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, tipped his hat to his female colleagues. "Leadership, I must fully admit, was provided primarily from women in the Senate." The Senate comprises 100 members. At the time of the 2013 fracas, its female faction was made up of 16 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Today, the Senate boasts 23 women. Only 52 have ever served. It's a paltry improvement, but leaps and bounds better than the fraction of women in power in other strata of influence. Just 6 governors are women. Only 24 Fortune 500 companies are women-led. That's less than 5%. Senator Shaheen wants to see the Senate look like America, with an equal gender split. Hers is a moderate stance. When asked at what point there will be enough women on the Supreme Court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg pronounced, "When there are 9. But even a modest increase in women could make a difference in how the legislative branch operates and votes and affects all our lives. The midterm elections will see more women than ever on the ballot. What we don't know is how many of these candidates will win. If current female incumbents hold their seats, a woman versus woman race in Arizona will inch the number of women in the Senate up to 24. Some pollsters think it's possible that Democratic Representative Jackie Rosen could win in Nevada, or Republican Representative Marsha Blackburn could come out ahead in Tennessee, which would push the number to 25 or 26 and create a coalition with far more influence than women have had so far. With a result like that, we'd be closer than ever to getting the answer to a question that has tantalized and divided political scientists for decades. What would happen to our gridlocked, superpartisan politics if women surpassed the tipping point? The idea of the tipping point dates back to 1977 when Rosabeth Moss Cantor, then a professor at Yale University and Harvard Law School, theorized the idea of critical mass as it applies to women in positions of power. Cantor observed that women had to make up at least 30% of a team to contribute at their full potential. Under that threshold, women were often dismissed as token representatives of their gender, not equal participants, let alone persuasive decision makers. Even since then, experts have debated the ideal proportion. Is it 35%? Would 25% be sufficient? Whatever the number, women in federal government haven't reached it. The point is to be included, not seen as an outsider, says Cantor, now chair and director of Harvard University's Advanced Leadership Initiative. Make no mistake, it does help to have one woman or a handful in the room where it happens. That was visible in April when Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois, gave birth to her daughter, Maylee. Less than 2 weeks later, she was back in the Senate, Maylee in tow, for a vote. But Maylee's presence there, let alone her warm welcome, would have once been inconceivable. Babies have been banned from the floor as far back as all the people who serve in the Senate could remember. When Senator Duckworth learned she was pregnant, she asked Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, to lead a bipartisan effort to strike down the rule. For months, Senator Klobuchar met with colleagues to convince them to support a reversal. Some on the Hill were worried about whether the horror Senator Duckworth would have to breastfeed. But Senator Klobuchar made her case, and the rule was overturned with unanimous consent. I think it would do us good to see a pacifier next to the antique inkwells on our desks, said Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois at the time. It's a nice sentiment, but it overlooks the fact that the United States remains the lone industrialized nation in the world that doesn't guarantee paid parental leave. Cantor believes that more elected women would lead to changes in policies like paid leave or access to health care. But Georgetown University professor Michelle Swerz, Ph.D., is more skeptical. While she acknowledges that women have unique experiences to draw on that make men view certain political issues with a fresh perspective, she cautions that women are not immune to the extreme partisanship that has infected Washington, despite the notion that women are reputed to be better at collaboration and risk assessment than men. At the national level, there's just less room for collaboration than there used to be, Swerz said. Even so, women in the Senate have tried to make the most of their low numbers. It was former Senator Barbara Mikulski, Democrat of Maryland, who set out to boost women's collective power with routine bipartisan dinners. Credit where credit is due, notes Senator Murray, because we took the time, separate from legislative action, to know where people come from. Then, when those impasses are reached, it's much more likely that someone will reach out and ask, how can we solve this? There's evidence, too, that women in office use their voice to different effect than men. In a 2010 University of Minnesota study, researchers found that women in the House of Representatives give more floor speeches. How else to be heard in public? And female politicians tend to emphasize issues that matter more to women and families, never mind that most families include men too. A deep divide into 2018 congressional transcripts found that female representatives spent more than twice as much time on health care in their speeches as male legislators did. Those efforts could have a greater impact in part because of the Jill Robinson effect. Two political scientists coined the term in 2011, positing that because bias makes it harder for women to get elected, those who do persevere are more adept lawmakers. The phenomenon is named after baseball icon Jackie Robinson, the first African-American to play Major League Baseball. To wit, the research found that Congresswomen claim up to 9% more in flexible dollars for their districts than congressmen do. Want to better fund education or health care in your area? Elect women. While business doesn't do much better than government when it comes to female representation, Women make up just 21% of corporate board seats in the S&P 1500. Active steps have been taken to boost their ranks. California recently passed bills that would require publicly traded companies in that state to have at least one woman on their board by 2020, and more women, depending on a company's size, by 2022. Europe has had such requirements for a decade. In 2006, for example, Norway established a quota for women on boards. France now has one, too. The aim for female representation is 40%. The laws were passed in the name of fairness, but they're also good for business. A 2016 report from global nonprofit Catalyst found that companies with three or more women on their board of directors, no matter the size, outperformed the competition across three crucial metrics: return on equity, return on sales, and return on invested capital. In other words, money, money, money. And research from Miriam Schwartz, Ziv, PhD, assistant professor at Michigan State University, has found that members of gender-balanced boards are twice as active, meaning likely to have initiative, as non-gender-balanced boards. That math underscores principles that William P. Lauder, executive chairman of the Estee Lauder Companies, says have been baked into the DNA of his family's business since its inception. In April, the company added two more women, Jennifer Hyman, co-founder and CEO of Rent the Runway, and Jennifer Tejada, CEO of PagerDuty, to the board, which means eight of its 17 directors are now women. For perspective, just three Fortune 500 companies have an equal number of male and female board members. Lauder chafes at the excuse that there are too few qualified women candidates in the pipeline. Lauder, a member of the 30% Coalition, an initiative to create more diverse corporate boards, maintains women are a value add for a company's board. Before beginning this latest search, he remembers he was explicit with his current board members. I said, here's what we need. We need expertise in cyber, and we need expertise in social and digital. On top of that, I said, we need more women directors. Those were the criteria, female, with those qualifications. Hyman notes that women are responsible for 85% of purchases in the U.S., so it just makes sense to empower them in business. Who better to know the consumer? She joined Estee Lauder because she trusted her opinion would be valued. It wasn't that they hit a number, she says. It was that they embraced the diversity of the people who were there across every metric. They say it out loud. When Ayanna Pressley became the first black woman ever to serve on the Boston City Council in 2009, she did not feel from the media, and the public at least, the kind of embrace that Hyman describes. What she remembers was the sense that people outside the council believed her success was owed to the idea that voters had wanted to elect a first. That narrative, she says, took away from what I had accomplished. After she defeated a 10-term incumbent for the Democratic nomination in September, Pressley is now expected to be elected to Congress in November. Pressley hoped that chatter would die down in 2013 when Michelle Wu was elected to serve on the council. But both women insist it wasn't until two more women, Anissa Esaibi George and Andrea Joy Campbell, joined in 2015 and pushed the 13-person council over the 30% mark, that their gender started to matter less. There had been a lot of pressure on us to represent this whole spectrum of womanhood, Wu says. Would we line up together? Would we take opposite sides? There was so much examination solely about our relationship with each other because we are women. The addition of Essaibi, George, and Campbell made clear that they serve their own constituencies, not just those who happen to have the same chromosomes. That's a freedom women in federal government, and Democratic women in particular, lack. When Senator Heidi Heitkamp, Democrat of North Dakota, declined to vote for stricter gun restrictions in the wake of the Newton, Connecticut shooting, she said in an interview with Time that the backlash from women nationwide surprised her. A female friend in the Senate said to me, "You know, it's because they feel you represent all women, not just the women of North Dakota." Earlier in 2018, as yet another government shutdown over how and whether to protect the Dreamers loomed, Senator Collins introduced a compromise bill that would have given the young undocumented immigrants legal status over time and fund border security. Her effort came closer than other prospective fixes, but failed in a 54-45 vote. An overwhelming number of female senators voted for her amendment, 18 in all. 4 opposed and 1 wasn't present. Senator Shaheen pointed out that with 6 more like-minded women, the bill would have passed. 9 or 10 more, and women would have had a critical mass and votes to spare. Perhaps the headline would have read, "Women Save the Dreamers." But a better result? If people had looked at the numbers and seen that more than 60 senators with different points of view found a path forward. That explains Ellen Powell, the activist who co-founded the nonprofit Project Include. After losing a gender discrimination suit against the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers in 2015, is the real purpose of a critical mass. The more women in power, the less gender has to be discussed. People need to focus on full representation for all people, Powell says, not just on gender, but on race, sexual orientation, age, and socioeconomic background. We have to keep that goal in mind and realize that 30% is nothing, or at least it's not enough. A threshold is not a destination. And this was by Maddie Kahn, K-A-H-N, who is a senior editor at Glamour. Well, that was quite something. Okay, well, we're going to lighten things up a little bit. And before November takes us completely away to December, I'm going to read you your November horoscopes. And this is, of course, from the October-November issue of 17 Magazine. All right, if you are in Aries, March 21st through April 19, your vision for what's possible will expand after auspicious Jupiter shifts on the 8th. If you can dream it, you can do it. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. After Mars moves into intuitive Pisces on the 15th, you'll know who's worth your time and who's killing your vibe. All right, that's today, 15th. All right, Gemini, May 21 through June 20. When Jupiter enters your zone of relationships on the 8th, you'll have a blast flirting with a new sweetie or two. Cancer, June 21 through July 22nd. After settling into your new space, you'll be itching for a scenery change, a day trip over Thanksgiving break, def counts. Leo, July 23 through August 22nd. Jupiter, the planet of good luck, will slide into your true love zone on the 8th, where it will stay for a whole year. Hola. Whew. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. After Mars swings into your area of relationships on the 15th, your iCal will be filled with awesome invites. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. Your social scene will get a huge boost after the sun moves into Sagittarius on the 22nd. This fall could be the goat. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21. With help from fiery Mars on the 15th, a flirty connection you made at the end of October will go from hot to hotter. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. Success-making Jupiter will be in your corner from now till the end of 2019. If you have a major goal, get cracking now. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. When Sagittarius links with the sun this month, you'll feel especially reflective. It's the perfect time to ask the big questions. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18. Not clicking with your usual crew? On the 22nd, the sun in Sagittarius will bring more like-minded peeps into your life. And Pisces, February 19 through March 20th. On the 15th, you'll get the green light on a dream when assertive Mars enters your sign. Enjoy the momentum, Pisces. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Kogal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by Kiwanis, that's Kiwanis, foundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Have a great week, and next week it'll be Thanksgiving. Let's get ready for that turkey. All right. Have a great week and have a good night. Good night.